Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Today, we're very excited to welcome to the store author Eric Kaplan. Kaplan's currently a writer and co-executive producer on The Big Bang Theory, and I can pretty much guarantee that at some point over his career he's made you laugh, even if you didn't realize it. As a writer for the Harvard Lampoon, The Late Show with David Letterman, Futurama, Flight of the Conchords, The Simpsons, Malcolm in the Middle, and many others. Today he joins us to discuss and sign his new book, Does Santa Exist? A Philosophical Investigation. Please join me in welcoming Eric Kaplan.
Hello. Thanks for coming. This book is called Does Santa Exist? A Philosophical Investigation. And I was thinking on the way over here, what is it that makes something a philosophical question as opposed to just a regular old question? Are there rhinos in the United States? Seems like it's a regular old question. And, you know, why am I here? That seems like a philosophical question. And how are they different? And I think the best answer that I can come up with is that if it's a philosophical question, who you are comes up. So in a sense, you can almost think, if you ever remembered studying math, that the teacher says to you, okay, you're done with arithmetic, we're going to introduce algebra. And there's this variable called x. And I'm going to tell you that if you add 2 to it, you get 5. And you're like, okay, I think it's 3. And the teacher's like, yeah, that's right, it's 3. But then they'll introduce the idea that there could be 2 variables. It's x plus y equals 5. And then you're like, well, there's a lot of things that could answer that. It could be 1 and 4. It could be 2 and 3. It could be 5 and 0. And I think when we're doing philosophy, we're solving a system with 2 variables, and one of the variables is us. So when we're asking the question, does Santa exist, we're also asking the question, are we the kind of people who want to say that Santa exists or believe that Santa exists? Maybe yes, maybe no. So that's what I'm talking about in this passage here. And the one thing that I refer to in the passage which I'm going to explain because I've discussed it earlier in the book, is this concept of Neurath's boat. So Otto Neurath was a 20th century, I think, German philosopher. And he was very interested in communication, and he's actually the guy who invented the international symbol alphabet, which shows like a person in a wheelchair or like kids running with a slash through it. He invented that. So that's interesting. And he came up with this notion of Neurath's boat. And it's a criticism of a philosophical project that was invented by Descartes called foundationalism. Now, I don't know if any of you read Descartes' Meditations or if you ever came across it, but Descartes said, we might believe a lot of things that are false. So here's what I'm going to do. This is Descartes. He says, I'm going to go into what he actually went into was a walk-in oven. He wasn't getting burned to death or anything. It was just like a warm room. And he said, I'm going to sit in this warm room, and I'm going to doubt everything that I could possibly doubt. So I'm going to get rid of all the things that I believe that are wrong, and I'll start at square one, and then I'll build up everything on a firm foundation. And in fact, the famous thing he said was, the one thing that I know is that I think, and from the fact that I think, I know that I exist, and then he's off to the races. Nobody in modern philosophy really thinks Descartes did a very good job. And Otto Neurath said, well, okay, here's the problem. You're never in the position to doubt all your beliefs. That's wrong. Don't think you're going to doubt all your beliefs and just come up with some basic ones and build everything else on it. Instead, he says, what you are like, not not you guys specifically, everybody. What everybody is like is a sailor who's in a boat on the open sea and has to rebuild his boat without landing. So we're in the process of changing our beliefs while we're still using them, while they're still part of our lives. And we cannot change so many that will sink, although over the centuries we may in fact change all of them. So I refer to Neurath's boat, and I'm going to start to talk about it. And this question of does Santa exist, it's not only for Santa freaks. It's really a way of talking about anything where we're not sure if we know if it exists. We're not sure. Some of us believe in it, some of us don't. Part of us believes in it, part of us doesn't. We believe in it sometimes, other times we don't. So if you're not interested in Santa, you can just search and replace Santa in my book with a Sharpie, and you can put in something that you are interested in, God or the self or the workers' paradise if you're a communist, whatever floats your boat. Okay, so now I'm going to start reading. By the way, this is my proposed schedule. I'll read, and then I'll answer questions, and then I'll sign books. Okay, since there's no objection, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, up until now, when we've asked the question, does Santa exist, or do I want to be a logician or a mystic, we have projected ourselves into the future and into other possible states of being. Neurath's boat is a way of imagining belief as a trip into the future. And we've tried different ways to answer the question of exactly what ticket we'd like to buy from that world historical travel agent. But all these questions about future selves beg a more fundamental question, which is how we want to experience life right now. And luckily, that ought to be the easiest question of all, because to answer it, we do not need to worry about philosophy or science. You can answer that question by just becoming mindful of this moment and how you feel about it, emotionally, intellectually, and physically. When you do, you will be able to bring your whole being online to come up with a response, not just your mind. Let's try. What do you want from each moment of life? If this moment were going to last forever, what would you like it to be? What's on your shopping list? Well, one thing you wouldn't want to be is absent-minded during it, because if you were, you would miss your only moment, right? That makes sense. So you would want a feeling of presence. What else? Would you want to experience an itch? No, right? No. Nausea? No.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, okay. We will give you Ipecac and ask you if you've changed your mind. Physical pain? No. Obviously, that would be awful. You would probably want pleasure. Neuroscience tells us there are two kinds of pleasure. I'm going to edit my text somewhat because there are younger ears listening. There are two kinds of pleasure. The pleasure of thinking that if you play your cards right, you will get food, which comes from dopamine, and the pleasure of satisfaction itself, which comes from endorphins. I think to have the feeling of being about to have pleasure for infinity but never getting it would be a tremendous ripoff. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. And so far today, my relationship with all of you have been nice. So let's go with the second one. Okay, so first attempt. If you could have one moment left, either because it will be prolonged infinitely or because you will be snuffed out after it, I hope not the second because, as I said, I like all of you, you would like it to be the pleasure of eating some delicious food or an endorphin high. Or would you? Now, I admit that it beats a kick in the teeth. It definitely gets partial credit. But most people who have the opportunity of directly administering endorphin highs to themselves by shooting up heroin or taking oxycodone, the hillbilly heroin, chose not to. For example, me. Now, I took oxycodone when I needed to donate bone marrow for my brother, and it was ridiculous how happy this stuff made me feel. I was literally singing a happy song in a cancer hospital. And it was also humiliating to learn that I had a switch in my head that could be turned from sad to happy by some stupid chemical. And I was very glad when I ran out of it. People who do end up picking a self-administered endorphin high, opiate and heroin addicts, aren't exactly happy with their life choice. It's degrading and brutalizing, a form of slavery. But in this thought experiment, you're allowed to pick whatever one moment would be. Could you take the pleasure of eating something delicious and add some sprinkles on top that would make it worthwhile as the only moment you're ever going to get? The actual moment of pleasure, I think, is pretty difficult to remember because, in a sense, you were not there. So if you pick your only moment of life to be intense physical pleasure, in a sense, it's a little bit like suicide. You won't be there to enjoy it. And as I mentioned, I don't want that for any of you. I like you. I'm a big fan. So let's add awareness. But what would you like to be aware of? You don't want to be aware of something distracting, obviously. It's your only remaining moment. So I think you want to be present for it. So you should be aware of something good. Now, I think this is starting to sound pretty good. Why? Why does it solve the problem of the heroin addict? Because your best moments don't just feel a certain way. They actually accomplish something that you care about. They matter. When we feel trivial and disconnected, that's bad. It feels bad. I hope you can now appreciate why it was such a terrific idea to put the question of Santa Claus and existence in general in the context of your own life, because now you can approach the problem of your favorite moment with your whole being and not just intellectually. Because we're running at it with your whole self, you can access the wisdom of bodily sensation. And your whole self tells you, if you're anything like me, that narcissism and solipsistic enjoyment make you feel bad. The idea gives one a kind of queasy, seasick feeling. Our gut read on the situation is that if we are floating brains in the matrix experiencing incredible pleasure, it feels weird and creepy. I think we feel that it's both not good and certainly not the best moment we're capable of. In other words, although there may be a selfish, disconnected mood in which you say, given the choice between the following two moments, A, experiencing incredible pleasure while making the world suffer, and B, experiencing a little bit of pain that makes the world feel okay, and you would pick A, there is no normal, healthy mood in which, given the choice between experiencing incredible pleasure that makes the world suffer and experiencing incredible pleasure that makes the world feel good, you would pick A. In other words, if you're going to feel great, if it's no skin off your back, you'd like other people to feel great too. I know you, and you're not the kind of person. You would not want to have pleasure and make everyone else suffer for no good reason. So for you, I don't know about your sister-in-law, but for you, if it's your last moment, all things being equal, you don't want to spend it being spiteful. You would like it to be a good one, not just for you, but for others. It just feels better that way. So what if we craft a situation in which your pleasure is super important? What if the universe is in danger from a monster who is about to eat it, and all that's needed to defeat him is for you to eat a delicious creme brulee? That way, in your final moment, you will get to be the greatest hero who ever lived and have the greatest pleasure anybody ever had. That's better than the oxiatic moment, except it involves conjuring into existence a universe-eating monster. Scary. Why do you need to create a universe-eating monster to have a nice moment? And once you've created this poor hungry guy, why do you have to kill him? Not to be all judgy or anything, but who's the real monster here? Okay. What if the creme brulee was doing something really good that did not require killing or monsters? What if there were another person, and your consumption of the creme brulee gave them pleasure? Now we're getting somewhere. Can it get even better? Sure. What if you taught that person to experience the pleasure of eating creme brulee for the very first time? They were blocked as far as cuisine or a virgin to creme brulee, and it was only the process of sharing it spoon to mouth to spoon that gave them bliss. I like this. What if instead of it being one person, it was every person, an infinite number of people, and you're sharing it with everybody, and they're all getting this incredible pleasure from the creme brulee? This is starting to sound very good. But I'd like to raise a problem. And I know a lot of you are going to say, problem? Everybody gets this infinite pleasure from the creme brulee at the same time? I don't see a problem. I don't want to see a problem. I'm buying it. Moving on. And that's the problem. It's boring, and it's obvious. It sounds like some kind of weird mixture of The Cooking Channel and Wired Magazine, probably because it's laid down by our biology in a sense, but also because we get that message from our media and our advertising 24/7. And there's nothing wrong with doing something fun again because it was fun the first time, but it's not the best, and we're looking for the best. All other things being equal, the best moments are fresh and surprising. You don't want to be bored. So what could we add to our moment, considering that it's already super pleasurable for us, and it causes super pleasure in infinite other people? How can it be made not boring and not a cliche? Well, some great pleasures that are not boring come from discoveries, learning something new, and solving problems. They can be intellectual or artistic or personal. The moment when you figure out what your calling is or what kind of pet to get or whom to marry or how to build a house. The experience of coming up with a great new solution can't be beat. So what if your perfect moment was one when you discovered some amazing new way to make yourself and everybody else feel amazing? And it was so different and so amazing that compared to it, the moment before was like the evil monster swallowing the universe. It was such an aha moment that it made what happened before seem dull by comparison. It was like the feeling Newton had when he saw the apple drop, or the feeling Beethoven had when he thought, bum, 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 bum. Well, that's a mental analogy. We had a physical analogy. How about an emotional one? Emotionally, as the song Nature Boy goes, the greatest thing is to learn that we're loved and to love in return. So, the best moment would be one that gives you maximum physical pleasure, emotional satisfaction, like learning you love and you're loved in return, mental pleasure, like the aha moment, and all in a way that's so fresh and exciting it makes your life up to that moment seem like the fifth cup you made with the same tea bag. Well, that's pretty good, but not perfect, because I don't want you to feel bad about the moment before. What kind of relationship do I want you to have with the moment before? I think you would like the present moment to be different from the moment before and better than it, but not different and better in a way that makes the moment before look in retrospect like garbage. You want to be grateful for the previous moment, but still enjoy a present moment that is inconceivably greater, richer, fresher, more interesting, and more enjoyable. In other words, the best moment doesn't just throw away the old moment and replace it with something new. The best moment grows out of the one before, like a strong creative adult grows out of a fun baby, or a big green broccoli plant grows out of a two-leaf seedling. Now, what if you think growth is boring? What if you think the way life produces a full-grown broccoli out of a two-leaf plant, or a creative, virile, or fertile adult out of a little baby, or the whole biodiversity out of Earth out of bacteria is boring? Then, sadly, you're out of your mind. If you prefer death to life, then I really do think you need help. Stop listening to this book and throw yourself into life. Grow a broccoli, take care of a child, milk a goat, walk. Notice the cycles of your own body. This is my one dogmatic claim in this book, and I'm sticking by it with the tenacity and self-righteousness of a super pope. If you're bored with life, the problem is with you, not life, because life is not boring. Plants, animals, ecosystems are the most interesting things there are. The proper response to boredom with life is to get into the body, get into the emotions, and get into the pulse of other lives, human or non-human. So, you're looking for a moment that matters, one that is fresh and limitless, and that grows out of the previous moment organically, like a shoot pushing up from the dirt. My claim is that Santa Claus or anything else exists if believing in them puts you in a brain state that can give you a moment like that. And the only way to know if you are in that sort of state right now, or if you're getting closer to it or further away, is by integrating your brain right now and seeing if you are. But couldn't you know if it mattered without going through it, because a really smart scientist told you, or a great priest, or a mystic, or Wikipedia? No. The most interesting things that matter happen because you learn how and why they matter by doing them. Yes, there are a lot of things that matter, and you knew they would matter before you did them. Like making my kid learn Spanish probably matters, and I knew that when I was socialized into being a middle-class parent and had make your kids learn things, it matters, drummed into my skull. But that's a more limiting and boring kind of mattering. The best kind of mattering is when this moment for you is a gateway into realizing that a whole bunch of things matter that you didn't know before and in a way you didn't know before. And by definition, you can't know that before you live through the moment. So if you want to know if something exists, see how it looks when you're in a good brain state. And if you want to know if a brain state is good, evaluate it according to how well it grows out of the life leading up to it and how much it fosters joy and mattering. Neurath was right. We start with a conception of what matters and we don't give it up. But along the way, we meet other people and fall in love with them and have children and we become their ancestors. As their ancestors, the web of genes and meeting that created us gives birth to them, and the things that sustain belief grow on the tree like apples. Every belief, whether it be in quantum fields or Kris Kringle, is an event in life. Life has a logic that is above and beyond the purely mechanical. While a mechanism can break, assuming whether or not something is a mechanism can be extracted from the purpose of the living being who made it, living things pass from immaturity to maturity and reproduction and to old age, and finally they die. Death is something we're finally ready to talk about, because now that we've imagined the perfect eternal moment, we've also by doing so imagined the perfect last moment. Because both moments, an eternal moment and the moment of death, have in common that they are the only remaining moment we're going to get. If we're able to face our last moment and give it a point or see its point, then we can give or see the point of our whole lives, because any moment could be our last. So what should our attitude be to a moment which could be our last? Surprisingly, some insight comes from the neuroscientist Porges, by way of a horrible story he tells about an experiment some scientists performed on rats. C.P. Richter, in his article on the phenomenon of sudden death in animals and man, reports that he took some rats, pre-stressed them by cutting their whiskers, and threw them into a tank to swim until they drowned. A previous theorist, Walter B. Cannon, predicted that the rats would be in a state of fight or flight, sympathetic arousal until death, then that they would die from the exhaustion of nonstop fear. And that turned out to be the case for tame rats, who swam in terror for several hours before dying. However, wild rats went into vagus shutdown and died in 15 minutes, peacefully. Now, which would you rather be, the wild rat or the tame rat? I'd rather be the wild rat. If I'm really at the end, I would rather go peacefully, mystically welcoming whatever the transition takes me to, even if it turns out to take me nowhere. It seems particularly awful that the tame rats were in a state of desperate terror and striving to the last moment. If we can respond to our death with peaceful acceptance, using a parasympathetic response rather than a sympathetic response, then we are responding to it with something like hope. Not a hope with a specific cognitive content, a specific belief that we will be in a green field, let's say, but a hope all the same. I like to think that a few minutes before my death, I will be in the mood for comedy, cracking jokes with friends and family members. But at the actual moment, I'd like to die as a mystic in vagal shutdown, free of thoughts, in love with the unknown. Any questions? Does anyone want to ask anything? I don't need to stand behind the podium. I can, well, maybe I do for the recording, but does anyone have any questions? Yes? Did you? You were simply moving your hand. Okay. Yes.
Hi.
Hi. In speech act theory, we call that a greeting. Yes. Yes.
How many places does your brain go normally when you're writing? Because this is so extremely different than, say, Futurama or. You know, like, I enjoy writing, so I'm trying to, like, grasp how you, like, is that really awesome? That's extremely different than writing comedy, so what do you do with all of that?
Well, you know, it's got some jokes in it. To me, I think there's a couple of differences between this and Futurama. I mean, Futurama is a collaborative show, so that's... It's like a group dance as opposed to, this is me dancing. Futurama is like a bunch of people dancing in a ring. So we're all contributing. We're all kind of finding a voice amongst ourselves. Also, Futurama has characters. And that's something that I like. I like to do things where I don't have to say what I think. I can just say, well, Bender said this, and Zoidberg said this, and Fry said this. But this book is a little different because it's all what I say. So, I mean, you could say maybe I'm a character. I've been accused of that by an allergist once. But I'm not a character like Zoidberg is a character because I'm real. So I am sort of saying things that I think and you know, going on a little journey myself and inviting the reader to come with me, which is a little different from creating a story where there's characters. It's not entirely different, but it's a little different. I hope that answers the question. Yes?
I just wanted to say that I think television, no character can be truly three-dimensional, because if you got three-dimensional, the show would be too complex.
What's it mean for a character to be three-dimensional? Well, no, it's not exactly. I'm asking a question. What does it mean for a character to be three-dimensional? Like, what's an example?
What does it mean? It means that, you know, they say things that are out of touch with their character or change opinions.
They feel surprising and they feel like they can change. What about movies? Do you think a movie can do that? So you think it has to do with change,
Yeah. That
there's a sense in which when we're writing a character, the character can't change, or the viewer won't understand what you're doing with the character. It's interesting. It could be true. I guess have to say I'm somewhat skeptical that it has to do with the medium that you're in, because I would think like, well, I don't know, like if you, I think Tony Soprano changes, I think Walter White changes, but it might have to do with maybe the it might have something to do with whether it's a mass medium or not. But that's an interesting point. Well, yeah, but I don't think you want to say that length dictates complexity. I mean, there's certainly short stories that have create a very, whatever, you know, Dubliners, those can be pretty short, and they give you what you want in terms of change. You know, do you like Dubliners? Have you ever read that? It's pretty good. It's a set of stories by James Joyce. And he invents this notion of an epiphany, which is pretty much like what you're looking for, that if someone goes along through the first part of the story and their life looks one way to them and they look one way to them, and then they have a moment where it all changes. And those are fairly short. So I don't think it – you might be onto something, but I personally wouldn't think it's due to the shortness of television. Yes? Oh, really? What happens with people who have been executed in the Middle East? Interesting.
The event as opposed to a struggle to avoid it. Recognizing that the struggle is futile.
Right, right. And, of course, a friend of mine read this, and he said, it's all very well to go for the acceptance if you know it's the last moment, but you don't, right? And I've seen a lot of movies, we were talking about movies before, where at the very last moment Batman comes in and rescues you from the terrorists. So if that were the case, then you would want to be have your wits about you to help Batman, you know, like pick up the rock and throw it at the terrorist or something. So that's the tricky thing. Yes?
Can I ask another question?
Yeah. By the way, this isn't like – I would hope feel a little bit more like a 20-person chat group than like, you know, me dispensing answers. Yeah.
The last moment thing made me think of something. So in comparison between Futurama and The Big Bang Theory, I know a lot of people that thought Futurama went on too long. Some people really liked the way that it ended, because I have friends on both sides of it.
Right.
Some people were really satisfied with it. Some people were like, oh, it should have ended sooner or whatever. Big Bang Theory, like, I know people that wish it would just go on and on and on forever. But
why do you think that is? Do they like the characters? Well, that's a weird thing. Like, sometimes when someone in your family is very old and their life is not good for them anymore, I found I want them to be around more. Like, I just want to have another week with them or another month with them. And yet, another part of me thinks, well, that's selfish. I got from them what they are, and I should enjoy who they are and what in the 80 years, 89 years I was with them, I should enjoy who they are, and I don't need to have an extra month or an extra week. And I think you kind of feel both ways. And I have to say my crack whenever people complain about television, on network television, which is, you know, it's free. So if you don't like it, you don't have to watch it. It has caused no harm to you that we make it. You just don't need to watch it. If you're getting it on basic cable, we can have a different discussion. But network television is just like the circular that people slip in your mailbox. Really, it's not much skin off your back if it's bad.
Yeah, I bought a pack of those. I think there's...
Yes?
I want to go back to the comment about changing characters.
Yes.
So I would think one of the spirits books... Five books,
sure.
You read it in Hebrew, they're even less words than English. And the characters...
And there are no vowels.
Right. And the characters change tremendously. And the complexity of the change, I think, is what makes it so interesting each time you look at the story and the words again. And satisfying.
Right.
I was just...
I think that's an excellent point. And do you think it's just in the Bible, or do you feel the same way in fairy tales or Greek myths or stuff like that?
I come from an Orthodox Jewish family, and we did not read fairy tales.
Right. Well, you said you came from an Orthodox Jewish family.
I'm not well versed in
so you haven't cracked a book since you left the Orthodox Jewish family?
No, I read a lot, but I wouldn't say I do like complexity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny. When you create a character, I think what you kind of one of the pleasures you get from a character is the feeling that the person is behaving in a way that's unexpected but also makes sense. Like, and I don't know what more to say about that, but it sort of seems like we like people who act differently and surprisingly, but at the end of the day you're like, of course Macbeth killed the king. He seemed like a nice guy when we met him, but he really was very ambitious. And when it comes down to his wife saying, go for it, and all he needed, and the witch is saying, go for it, he did it. And that makes sense. So it's sort of, I would say, Macbeth, you know, probably the characters in Shakespeare and the Bible, those are the two deepest set of characters that we have to draw on. So, and I think what we see is this sort of, they do amazing things, but on some sense we feel there's one person there. Maybe it comes from the character of God in the Bible, that God is this character who, like, is mysterious and yet one. So he does a variety of amazing things, and he's hard to understand, but you sort of feel like there's one personality there. You had a question back there?
Well, I just couldn't hear all of the conversation.
Oh, you couldn't hear. Well, come up. Come to the front. But you're not in church. You sit in back everywhere. Okay. I don't know if the Pope would agree.
He wants us to move forward.
He wants you to move forward, exactly. And the thing is, if you're a Catholic and the Pope tells you not to be humble, you can't disobey him. Any other questions? This is fun. Yeah. One page of me, one page of Vonnegut, one page of me.
It was like half of Slaughterhouse-Five and then 30 pages and then the rest of it.
Cool.
And, I thought that you kind of had similar feelings. I don't know if you named the same ideas, but what do you think of that idea that all time takes place? All time really is taking place now. You can make choices.
Well, I don't think that's true now, but it might be true in a couple of weeks. All time takes place now, but what about stuff that happened before?
Well, it's a weird concept, saying that we perceive time as something we can't control, but just keep moving forward. But in reality, it all kind of exists.
Right, yeah. I've heard about that. I've heard about the idea that everything is a... You kind of come across an idea, something like that in Spinoza, that he says you should look at everything from the viewpoint of eternity. And you will say that, like, everything is this four-dimensional manifold, and it's just, I'm just a space-time worm that began in 1967, and it looped around a couple different places, and it ends, and whenever I'm going to die. And those, in some sense, all exist at the same time. And that's a neat way of looking at the world. But it seems to me it's not faithful to our experience of choice. Because we do, I don't know if you have this, but I sometimes feel like, well, I decided to have a kid. And if I hadn't decided to have a kid, that kid wouldn't be here. So in some sense, the fact that there were something that happened and then something else happened and then after that something else happened is also true. I think it's a deep question. I mean, you know, the Upanishads sort of say something like that. They say that, like, time and space are given off by the mind almost like a snail produces a shell. And they're probably right, so you're probably right. Yeah. Any other? Is it good?
It's very good, but they talk.
There's time paradox. That's become the new thing. Is time paradox? As it was in Harry Potter too. Did you see that? Do you think that the Chris Nolan saw Harry Potter and was like, "I'm going to do some of that"?
I don't know. That would be amazing.
Any, yes, young lady in the back.
I feel like I'm going to admit that I haven't read.
Well, part of the purpose of this is to encourage people to read it, so people should not be embarrassed that they haven't read it already. That's what I was hoping. Yeah.
But I get a sense just from hearing the reading that you're talking a great deal about the quality of consciousness. And so I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about consciousness itself, and is the quality of it important enough that lying to yourself doesn't matter as much as the quality? In other words, is denial okay if it makes me happy?
Well, if you can pull it off, I mean, I guess it's okay. I mean, I guess maybe the question is, does it hurt you and does it hurt anybody else? And is it as good as what else is available to you? Like suppose, let's say, I don't know. Give me an example of denial. I shouldn't have to come up with all the examples today.
Denial as when you know that something isn't true, but you like to believe.
But give me a concrete example.
Yeah. Potato chips are not fed.
Well, that's not great. because if you want to have healthy coronary arteries because you want to see your grandchildren, and the way to get those is to not eat fattening food, and you lie to yourself and say that potato chips are not fattening, then you run the risk of getting heart disease and not seeing your grandchildren. So I would say that in that case, it's not a great strategy. Now, if you say, "Well, there's a zombie plague upstairs, and probably we're all going to get killed, but there's a chance we won't," so we lie to ourselves and say we've got an excellent chance of surviving in order to make it through. Well, that might be the best thing available, right? Because the alternative is a degree of terror that we can't handle and would immobilize us. So I don't know. I don't have a general answer, but you know. I'm sure you could figure it out. Did you have a follow-up?
Because I wanted to hear your... I think a lot about consciousness and awareness and what it is.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what... I mean, consciousness is the strangest... it is what I am. So it's very hard to talk about it or to describe it. And I wondered about your thoughts.
Well...
I got a sense that the book...
I think it's one of those... it's one of those things that we cannot define in terms of something more basic. And it kind of makes sense, right, that if you're going to explain things in terms of something else, at some point you're going to run into something that you can't explain in terms of something else. Now, it seems that it's got something deep to do with time. It's got something deep to do with volition. It's got something deep to do with pleasure and pain. So I think it's connected on a deep level to those things. But I don't think we're ever going to be able to explain it in terms of physical causation. That's just my hunch, and if someone proves me wrong tomorrow, then I'll recant. But I think that it'll be more likely at the end of the day that we'll learn that matter is some kind of weird form of consciousness than that we'll learn that consciousness is some kind of weird form of matter. That's my feeling. Because I don't see how, like, just the experience of being aware could be explained in terms of something more fundamental. That's my approach. And I think it's, I don't know, it's a deep question, but I don't, Spinoza says something. I'm kind of on a Spinoza kick these days. And he says, well, there's something which he calls God or nature, and it has attributes. And one of its attributes is extension, space, and one of its attributes is consciousness. And it's just this infinite thing, which we're all part of, and it is both conscious and extended. And I don't think he feels he can explain extension in terms of consciousness or consciousness in terms of extension. And I might think that too. I don't know. I don't quite understand it yet. I'm working on trying to figure out Spinoza, and right now it seems like it's going to take a lot of work. But at the end of the day, he might be right if I can figure out what he means. Any other questions? Yes. My favorite TV shows. I really liked Episodes a lot, which was a show about the making of TV. I really liked I've been watching In Treatment, which is on HBO, and it's a Gabriel Byrne, has all these different patients, and he's their therapist. Anytime I turn on TV and there's something about, like, how whales live or wolves or something like that, I like that because they seem to have these new cameras now where you can almost, like, you can, like, get in the prairie dog tunnel and you see the baby prairie dogs being born. So I like those. I liked Breaking Bad. I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know. TV is good. I'm not 100% crazy about TV because it takes so much time. Like, I feel like in an hour I could read a lot more words in a book than watch them on a television set. And also, I often don't like to have my consciousness controlled by an external thing. Like, I rather, like, surf around Wikipedia for an hour than watch television. But, you know, sometimes if I'm tired. Oh, no. Well, by the time my show is on TV, I've seen it 10 times and I've read the script 100 times. So I have no interest in watching it. I know it pretty well. Are there any other questions? Yes.
One question about, not entirely sure how this would relate back into.
It didn't have to relate to anything. Just, you know, we're all here. I don't know if anyone needs to go. You're excused, but we're just going to talk about some question that doesn't seem to be related clearly to anything. That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I mean, part of me thinks it may have something to do with this concept of a supernormal stimulus. Have you ever heard of that? Like, there are birds that like to sit on round eggs, and then if you give them a volleyball, they will ignore their real egg in order to sit on the volleyball because their tiny, stupid bird brain is hooked up to sit on anything that's round and white. The rounder and whiter, the better. So they'll ignore the real egg. That's a sort of a cynical approach. I mean, so it's possible that the fiction character is a supernormal stimulus, and it's interesting and funny, and it's all the sort of things that a regular person is, but more so because it's fake. So that's one element that goes into it. I also think, in a certain sense, they're means for us to process and think about what's most important to us. So, like, for example, you're like, well, I have a girlfriend. Do you love your girlfriend? Sure, I love your girlfriend. I love my girlfriend. Well, would you kill someone to save her? Well, that's never come up, you know. But if I watch a television show or I read a book about a guy who loves his girlfriend so much that he killed someone, then that's pretty gripping because it's dealing with this sort of deep question that I have, my love for my girlfriend versus my love for people I don't know versus my fear of getting caught. All those things get presented in a stark way. So my emotions, which are, I don't know why I have emotions, but I think I sort of have emotions to guide me through life as a physical being. So my emotions help guide me through life. And then this example of the character, who's this very stark, extreme version of the kind of what it is to be a person. It's helping me solve the problem of what it is to be a person. That's my. So it's one of the two. maybe they're two versions of the same answer. But it's some combination in my mind of the supernormal stimulus idea and the idea that it's kind of a way to help guide me in my reflections on how to be a person. I don't know. Yes.
This has caused me to ask a question.
Good.
It's about my husband.
All right. Is he here?
No.
Okay. It seems slightly unfair. Okay. Okay. Some person, we'll call him Mr. X, who may or may not really be your husband. Yes.
He has had many careers. He was a lawyer. He was an engineer. He was cowboy?
Cowboy, soldier. He sounds great. Why do you have any questions? You should.
Because he had to read a lot, and he reads a lot, and he has studied a lot, and he's been around a lot.
Sounds a bit of a bookworm. I don't like it. Hogan's Heroes. Oh, The Big Bang Theory.
It drives me crazy.
All right. Have you considered nagging him?
So I go to, I understand all this consciousness and all this Spinoza and all this Shakespeare and the Bible characters and all this business, but I don't understand what my husband does.
Well, have you sat down and watched it with him? Have you asked him?
My husband is.
It's a little like church. I think we've come. Don't ask me why he does it. You should ask him why he does it, right?
Well, I have.
And what does he say?
I think he says.
Stop bothering me. I'm watching my TV.
Which is so non-intellectual for him because he usually has all these rational reasons why he does everything he does except for TV.
Maybe it fulfills an emotional need for him. Well, there you have it.
I just don't know what emotional need.
Well, what are his emotional needs?
I don't know.
Oh, you should talk to him. I'm not going to tell you. That's inappropriate for me to tell you what your husband's emotional needs are.
That's why I held back.
I think it's a good question. No, we are chit-chatting. I think maybe he likes to see the adventures of clowns and foolish persons. And maybe it makes him feel relaxed. Maybe. I don't know.
Because he has a very serious job.
So maybe it's helping him unwind. Yeah.
Very serious job.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a copy of this. I was undecided if I was going to buy it. Now I'm definitely going to buy it.
Okay.
I really want to share it with my 16-year-old niece who's in that mind space of, I don't know what I believe, and I'm very curious.
Right.
Unsettled kind of, feeling, whatever. But I was also wondering, would it offend, my dad's a minister, would it offend him if I offered to let him read it? Because he's an open-minded person, but he obviously replaced Santa with God, and he would obviously be on one side of it automatically.
Well, I don't think it would offend him at all. I mean, my feeling about religion is I think we're unfortunately split into two camps where there are people who are religious and think everyone who's not religious is wicked, and there's people who are not religious and think everyone who is religious is a fool, and I think that's bad. So my book is essentially it's pretty pro religion actually. So I think he would probably dig it, or at least he would have an interesting take on it. It's certainly not going to offend him. And if he's a minister, he's probably got a pretty thick skin. He's dealing with a lot of tough characters.
Yeah.
Anything else? Yes. Well, okay, so I didn't come up with the characters for The Big Bang Theory. I joined the show in the second season. When I do come up with characters, usually they're some version of me or people I know, but I kind of whittle away at them until I sort of feel that there's some point. So I'll be like, wow. Like, there's a guy who's I'm friends with, and he's very, very smart. He's much smarter than me. He's a math professor, and he sort of, I think in some weird way, pretends his life isn't really happening to him. Yeah. And I haven't quite figured out what that is, but I think in some sense he thinks he's not living his life. It's just some weird problem that he's solving. So I would like to do a character based on him, but when I'm doing it because that particular aspect of his personality interests me. And I think, you know, everybody has many variables, and, you know, the story, if I wrote a character about you based on you and your wife wrote a character based on you, they'd be quite different because we have different agendas. So basically I'm taking myself, I'm taking people who I've met, but I'm picking out whatever feature of them seems to kind of upset me or interest me or delight me, whatever. Okay, so that's enough chatting with me, but I'm going to sit here and sign books, and then we can chat more. And thanks, everybody. Oh, I did the thing. I didn't do the thing I was supposed to do. I was supposed to repeat all your questions. Too late. But anyway, thanks for coming. If you buy the book, I hope you enjoy it. If you read another book, I hope you enjoy that one. Okay.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.